WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Americans are becoming more aware of the work of the special forces through the war against terrorism and the movie and book Black Hawk Down. My guest, General Carl Steiner, was the second commander-in-chief of the U.S. Special Operations Command, responsible for the readiness of all the special operations forces of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, including the Green Berets, Navy SEALs, Rangers, and psychological operations. General Steiner commanded the special forces from 1990 to 93. Before that, he commanded many of the military's contingency strike forces. He's retired now. His earliest missions were in Vietnam. Now he's written a new history of the special forces with best-selling writer Tom Clancy and Tony Kultz called Shadow Warriors: Inside the Special Forces. It's part of Clancy's Commander series. General Steiner told me that the training for the special forces is highly specialized.
They are trained for certain, we call it mission areas of responsibility, such as long-range reconnaissance, search and rescue, direct action missions, disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, which could be demining activities like they've been involved in for Afghanistan long before they were inserted in the war against terrorism, and many other mission areas. In addition to that, they are trained in their own specialties. They are culturally oriented and trained so that they know how to fit into the environment, how to survive in a respected way, be accepted in a respected way in the environment. And they're also language trained. So their training lasts from some of their military occupational specialties up to 3 years before they ever become effective as an operational part of an aid detachment.
Now, you mentioned in the book that some of the training includes sensory deprivation. What's that aspect like?
You're looking for a person that has the inner strength and wherewithal to give 110% of himself 24 hours a day, every day, without having to be stroked. So they are placed in an environment where we call separate sensory deprivation, where they're given requirements to accomplish, but they're never told how well they're doing.
So that they learn to be independent, because they're not going to be praised in the middle of a mission. They're not going to get any positive feedback.
No, that's exactly right. Because you're in situations where you are expected to make the right kinds of decisions, tough decisions, quickly in the absence of orders.
You joined the Special Operations in 1964. What was the focus then?
The focus then, up until that point, had been primarily the mission area of unconventional warfare. That was their main role in World War II during the Jedburgh days, jumping behind the lines in France and carrying out ambushes and sabotage operations against to disrupt the German forces as much as possible. And that had carried over. But in 1961... General Yarborough, who had taken over the Special Warfare Center, had a vision that the challenges around the world created by Soviet-inspired insurgencies were increasing and Vietnam was looming on the horizon. So our mission areas expanded to one of deep, long-range reconnaissance, counterinsurgency-type advisory and assistance operations, search and rescue, and many others. And that was the focus of our training at that particular time.
Now, you were in Lebanon in 1983 when a suicide truck bomb destroyed the American Marine barracks. What did you do afterwards? What was your job to do in response?
I was there as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense representative on the ground to report back daily as to what was happening, to interface directly with General Tanous, the Lebanese Armed Forces, the American ambassador that was there, and as necessary with the government of Lebanon, because we had a military assistance program going there. And the Lebanese Army was being upgraded to be ethnically representative of the mix of the population. And it was making great progress, and it was an army that respected each other. And the mission was to bring peace and stability to Lebanon. And I also had an additional duty as a military advisor to then Don Rumsfeld, who was carried the rank of ambassador and was designated as the president's special envoy for trying to find a solution to peace in the Middle East. When the Marines were blown up and the French about 5 minutes after that, that morning I was sitting in the office of General Tanousse. This was early Sunday morning, having my daily meeting with him and finding out what his plans were for the Lebanese Army's employment for that particular day. When that explosion went up, we saw it out the window of his office, and we felt the shockwave. I said, "That's the Marines." He said, "Lord forbid, let's go." And we ran down and jumped in his car. We didn't take a military vehicle. He felt it would be quicker to go through West Beirut, which was predominantly no man's land at that particular time, to get there soonest. And as we went through town, you could see the people that had been rocked out of their beds by this explosion out on their porches looking in the direction of the Marines. We got there, I would say, in 7 to 10 minutes and saw what had happened. We stayed there for about 10 to 15 minutes while we looked at that and found the commander, and General Tanousse offered him the support of all the heavy equipment that was in Beirut at that particular time, trying to clean up the rubble from the war that had taken place and was still ongoing. And he moved a battalion of the Lebanese Army in to secure the place while they tried to recover the dead and the wounded. And after about 15 minutes there, we went about a mile away to where the French compound was to link up with them. The disaster there had not been nearly as bad because the timing was about 5 minutes off. As far as everybody knew, it was the two bombs were scheduled to explode at the same time, but the one that hit the French was delayed by about 5 minutes, and therefore they had that much warning time, having heard the U.S. Marines being blown up, and they were shooting at the truck when it approached their compound.
Had you been prepared for the idea of a truck bomb or a car bomb? How much of that had happened before?
The U.S. Embassy was blown up in 1982 in Beirut, and that was the first use of a bomb that was in a van. There had been some intelligence to indicate that something significant would happen. In fact, one of the intercepts indicated that we will perform the spectacular act and make the feet shake underneath, make the ground shake underneath the feet of the infidels. And based on that, all possible measures were taken to try to determine what this meant. There were several natural caves that ran under Beirut, led in from the sea, the Mediterranean. They were all searched by the Lebanese Navy. Seismic detection devices brought in to see if someone could possibly be digging under these compounds or in the vicinity of them. And nobody suspected a truck bomb at that particular time. And we never were able to determine what the method of attack would be until it actually happened.
The Islamic extremist group Hezbollah took responsibility for the truck bomb that blew up the Marine barracks. What were the difficulties for you then trying to penetrate an extremist religious group?
It was very difficult because if you recall when the embassy was blown up in 82, the CIA station chief and all of his staff except for two were killed in that. And that sort of neutralized our human intelligence collection capability for that part of the world. And you cannot penetrate these religious-based fanatical organizations by overhead systems, referring to satellites. You have to have human intelligence that's capable of doing that. So we were comparatively blind as to the threat as compared to what we had hoped to have in terms of early warning and intelligence, and plans that this organization was trying to bring to bear against American interest in that part of the world.
My guest is General Carl Steiner, the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Special Operations Command. He's written a new book with Tom Clancy called Shadow Warriors, Inside the Special Forces. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is retired General Carl Steiner from 1990 to 93. He was the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Special Operations Command. He's written a new book about the Special Forces with Tom Clancy and Tony Kultz. A lot of people are learning about the Special Forces from the book and movie Black Hawk Down. I asked General Steiner about the portrayal of the Special Forces in the film. You know, a lot of the story of Black Hawk Down is about, the command to leave no man behind. And so we see men risking their lives to bring out the bodies of Special Forces men who were killed in battle. And we see men dying while bringing out the bodies. And when I was watching the movie, I was really wondering about that leave no man behind approach. What's the reason behind it? And do you think it's always a good thing? I mean, do you think there's times when it's not wise to risk the lives of the living to bring out the bodies of the dead?
Terry, that's our culture. It is very important to the soldiers involved to know that their bodies will not be left and desecrated on the battlefield. And therefore, every reasonable effort is made to recover everybody, wounded or dead. But there are times when the commander has to make the decision as to whether more would be lost in attempting to recover bodies than to leave them there and go back another time. And that's that's a commander's decision that's left up to him.
I suppose I shouldn't ask you to second-guess anybody else's command, but would you have made the decision to leave no man behind in that mission in Somalia?
I would have done everything possible without sacrificing a lot of lives to recover those people, because you didn't know where they were dead or still alive at that particular time.
I imagine the fear of having your body desecrated is a pretty serious fear when you're a soldier, particularly if you're doing these special operations missions. What impact did it have on you when dead American soldiers were dragged through the streets of Somalia?
Personally, it was not a shock to me, because that's the culture over there and the environment in which they're in. But it was a very traumatic experience to Americans that were watching that sort of thing happen back here and wondering how on earth it could happen and how we got ourselves involved in that predicament to begin with.
Let me ask you what you think of the movie Black Hawk Down. Have you seen it?
Yes, I have. It is very authentic, very realistic, and that's the way it was.
What lessons do you think the Special Forces Command learned from that mission?
The main lesson is you absolutely do not have to operate in daylight unless it is it's necessary for the accomplishment of the mission. It's much better to operate during darkness. That was one lesson. I'd say the second lesson is, if you're going to go into a situation like that, you need to have a rescue force standing by with the firepower that can punch its way in and rescue those that may be entrapped or react to unforeseen, unanticipated contingencies or crises that may occur during the operation.
You're retired now. I'm wondering if there are emotions that you can allow back in your life that you can't allow in your life when you're actually in the Special Forces, because you have to be so tough and so invulnerable and so not full of doubt and not questioning your capabilities. You just have to keep performing and keep handling it.
Yeah, I don't think my life has not changed one bit. You know, I am what I am, and that's about all the only way I can answer that question.
Okay. One other question. On the back of your new book, there's a picture of you and Tom Clancy. Clancy is wearing dark glasses and a cap that says Vipers on it. He's wearing a leather jacket. You're standing there. You're just wearing khaki pants and a blue button-down shirt. You look like you're on your way to the office, you know, on Casual Friday.
Yeah, right.
So it's interesting to me that you're not striking the special forces pose at all. You're not trying to look like the tough guy or wearing the tough guy clothing. Yeah.
No, you know, I hadn't even thought about that in the picture, but you know, that tough guy image does not prevail. You know, many times special forces personnel, while they're on active duty, dress appropriately for the environment in which they operate. It may be a coat and tie. It may be black if they're on some kind of a special action type mission. Or it may be fatigues, camouflage fatigues. If they're on a deep reconnaissance mission, they just dress so they can blend in and survive and accomplish the mission. And in civilian life, they do not wear clothes that would distinguish them as special operations forces.
Well, General Steiner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Terry, thanks a million for giving me this opportunity to be on your program. You do a great job, and thank you.
General Carl Steiner is the former Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Special Operations Command. His new book, written with Tom Clancy and Tony Kultz, is called Shadow Warriors: Inside the Special Forces.